Thank you for choosing to take a self-guided GPS-enabled tour of Three Tours by Foot. We believe in operating quality tours that are affordable to everybody, regardless of their budget, and we hope that you enjoy your tour with us today. You've chosen to come along on our Jack the Ripper tour. This is a tour for adults or mature teenagers. Throughout the walk, we will discuss the unsolved, brutal murders of five East End prostitutes. There'll be detailed descriptions of crime scenes and vivid retellings of the horrific slayings carried out by an unidentified assailant known as Jack the Ripper. This walk will take you back to Victorian Whitechapel, when it was one of the most impoverished locations in the country, and we will tell you the stories of the women who were killed, as well as looking at how the case was handled, why it was never solved, and even theories as to who Jack the Ripper may have been. On the tour today, you can expect to walk nearly 3 miles or just under 5 kilometers. The tour will last, on average, around 2.5 hours, although this may change depending on your walking pace or stops you may wish to make along the way. For guests with mobility issues or those with prams or buggies, there are no steps on the route, but there are cobbled streets to take into consideration. The self-guided Jack the Ripper walking tour begins near Whitechapel Underground Station. Our story begins on the 31st of August, 1888. The Autumn of Terror, as it was dubbed by the press, is about to begin when the first victim of the Canonical Five is murdered right here, Mary Ann Nichols. For reference, Canonical Five refers to the five women generally agreed upon as having been murdered by Jack the Ripper. There are some who believe other murder victims in the Whitechapel area toward the end of the Victorian era were also Ripper victims, but only these five are universally accepted. 43-year-old Mary was known to her friends as Pretty Polly. Not because she was beautiful, however. Without being cruel, the women we'll be discussing today were weather-beaten. A hard life of street living and alcoholism took their toll, leaving many women looking around 20 years older than they actually were. Skin disorders, missing teeth, and the ravages of outdoor living had left their toll on these women. All but one of the Canonical Five were in their 40s, having lived long, difficult, and often dangerous lives. Mary Ann Nichols, though, had started off reasonably well, by Victorian standards. She was married at the age of 15, but her marriage fell apart around the time she turned 29. The police report stated that her marriage failed owing to Mary Ann's, quote, excessive drinking and immoral behavior. With no more financial support from her husband and having sold all of her possessions, Mary had no choice but to sell herself to make ends meet. On the evening of the 31st of August, Mary was drinking at the Frying Pan pub, where we will take you later, and left around 12:30, wearing a beautiful new bonnet with expensive black trim that she had purchased herself, believing this might help her attract new clients. When she left the pub, she headed straight for her current accommodation, a doss house on Thrall Street. But owing to her bonnet and all the time she had spent at the pub that day, she arrived without the 4 pence needed to stay for the night. The landlord turned her away. No pay meant no stay, and this particular landlord had actually been quite generous to Mary. She already owed him money for previous nights she had stayed without paying. However, Mary wasn't concerned by this. Quote, "Look at my jolly new bonnet," she said to him. Quote, "It won't take me long to earn my 4 pence and keep my room." With that, she headed back out into the night. 2 hours later, around 2:30 in the morning, she was spotted on the Whitechapel High Street by her best friend, Ellen Holland, who found Mary so drunk she could barely stand. Ellen tried to convince Mary to go back to the Doss House, even offering to pay the 4 pence herself. Mary refused, saying, quote, "I've had my Doss money 3 times tonight." She had spent it all on gin, but reckoned it'd be easy to get the fourth. An hour later, at 3:40 in the morning, two stable hands, Charles Cross and Robert Paul, were heading to work in the pitch dark when Cross spotted something out of the corner of his eye. At first, Charles was excited, thinking he'd found something, a tarp or a bundle of rags that he could sell, perhaps. As he got closer, however, he began to make out that it was, in fact, the body of a woman, lying on her back with her legs spread and her skirts lifted above her neck. Charles wasn't sure if she was alive, dead, drunk, injured, or just sober and asleep, but he didn't want to wait around to find out. He was afraid that if he was found there, he could be implicated in a crime if it turned out the woman was in fact dead or injured. Charles and Robert decided to leave the scene and alert the first police officer they saw as they continued their walk to work. Almost immediately after the boys left, Police Constable, or P.C. Neal, arrived on the scene with his lantern. At first, he kicked Mary, yelling at her to wake up and telling her she couldn't sleep there. When she didn't move, he knelt down to pull her skirts down in an effort to protect her modesty. But when he did, he saw that her throat had been violently slit, from left to right, twice over, with the incision going all the way back through to her vertebrae. He immediately called for assistance, and the Metropolitan Police arrived on the scene. With photography unavailable, Mary Ann Nichols' body lay unmoved for 3 hours, while the police drew sketches of the crime scene. A doctor was summoned to take Mary's body away for study, and when he arrived, he noticed something a bit unusual. There seemed to have been very little blood surrounding the body, given the brutal nature of her murder. Finally, Mary's body was removed, and of course, with forensic science in its infancy, as soon as Mary's body was taken away, buckets of water were splashed all over the crime scene, erasing any clues that may have been hidden there. When her body was taken back to the lab, the doctor discovered that there was a very good reason for the small amount of blood left at the scene. This was owing to the fact that Mary Ann Nichols was wearing 9 layers of clothing. For women with no permanent place to stay and nowhere to store their belongings, wearing their entire wardrobe all day long was a necessity. And it's these many layers of clothing that had soaked up all of Mary's blood, leaving only a little left behind in the alleyway in which she was slain. As the doctor carried out the autopsy, the true extent of Mary's injuries came to light. She had been stabbed multiple times in the genital organs, and a wound created by the rip of a knife stretched from her pelvis all the way to her chest. Her skin had been pulled back, and her internal organs had been repeatedly slashed. This will soon become the calling card of Jack the Ripper, horrible mutilations with a focus on the female reproductive organs. Detective Chief Inspector Frederick Aberline is called to work on the case, and he is determined to bring Mary's killer to justice. But having retraced her steps over and over and spoken to any and everybody that had contact with her, Frederick found nobody with a bad word to say against Mary Ann Nichols. With no idea of a perpetrator or motive, an entire week passed with no progress on finding her killer. But 7 nights from the murder of Mary Ann Nichols, Jack the Ripper would strike again. Backtrack along Durward Street until you get to Valence Road and turn right. Take the first left onto Old Montague Street and immediate right onto Hanbury Street. Continue on Hanbury Street for quite some time. As you walk, you will pass Deal Street, Daplin Street, Spittle Street, and you will cross Brick Lane until you finally reach a car park on the right-hand side, opposite numbers 28 or 32 Hanbury Street. Please listen to our next clip as you walk, and we will describe what life was like for the citizens of this area 120 years ago. As you stand outside the car park, look towards numbers 28 and 32 opposite you. This is exactly what the buildings that used to stand on this side of Hanbury Street would have looked like in the 1880s. The house where Jack the Ripper's second victim, Annie Chapman, was murdered, no longer stands, but it would have looked similar to the houses you see across the street, such as numbers 28 and 32. Notice the 2 doors on each shop front. One of those would have been a door leading upstairs to accommodation. The other would have been a door that was left open at all times, and behind it was a pathway that led behind the house and into the communal courtyard. These doors were always kept open for what's known as soil men, who would come here to collect buckets that had been left in the gardens. These buckets, used at a time before indoor plumbing, held human waste, and as horrible as the job of collecting these buckets might sound, it was quite a lucrative job. Urine could be sold onto leather makers who used it on their animal hides, and the soil, as it was called, was sold onto farmers. A small space off the street that offered a little privacy through a door that was always kept open made the back gardens of Hanbury Street a popular location for prostitutes to take their clients, and Annie Chapman was one such woman. Annie was in bad shape. She had tuberculosis, and unknown to her, she was dying. Despite the fact she was so ill, Annie was a tough lady. So were all of Jack the Ripper's victims. These weren't delicate wallflowers. These girls got into physical altercations constantly, fighting with Johns or other women. The constant state of drunkenness most of them lived in contributed to the volatile behavior and violent scenes that were all too commonplace among those who were living on these streets. In fact, Annie had recently been in a fight just a week beforehand with another prostitute called Eliza Cooper over a bar of soap she had borrowed. Annie suffered severe bruising to her chest and lost all of her bottom teeth in this confrontation. Eliza ended up in hospital. So Annie was not having a great time. She was ill, hurt, and tired. She turned up to a regular doss house around 10 past 5 in the morning on the 8th of September without the money to pay for her night's stay. She begged and pleaded with the owner to let her stay, and even promised to pay him double the next day if he allowed her to come in until the sun came up. Her pleas fell on deaf ears. She had no choice but to go back out onto the streets and try to earn that crucial 4 pence. Shortly after, Annie was spotted talking to a man outside the front of 29 Hanbury Street. He was described as 5'7" or 8", late 20s or early 30s, white male with a mustache. He was said to have been wearing a deerstalker hat and a long, dusty black overcoat. He had his hand on Annie's chest and reportedly said, quote, "Will you?" To which she replied, quote, "I will." They then headed straight through the garden entrance into the back courtyard. Annie would never come out. At approximately 5:20 a.m., a man called Albert Kadosh came downstairs to use the facilities in his back garden next door, separated from the garden Annie had gone into by a small fence that stood only around 5'6" tall. Albert claimed he heard a woman shout the word, "No," and a sound like something falling against the fence. But in Whitechapel, early in the morning, with drunk and violent people wandering the streets, none of this was unusual. In fact, Albert never even bothered to look over that 5'6" fence. Had he? Perhaps he would have seen and then been able to identify Jack the Ripper himself and prevent the rest of the murders that were to come, a decision Albert regretted for the rest of his life. At 5:40 a.m., John Davis, a man living above 29 Hanbury Street, came downstairs and into the back courtyard where he discovered the body of Annie Chapman. She was slumped against the fence, with her throat slashed and her body cut open from her groin to her chest, nearly cut into two. Her intestines had been pulled out and slung over her shoulder, and later it be discovered that part of her bowel and her entire uterus were both missing. This crime scene was different from the other Jack the Ripper murder scenes in a very odd way. The murderer had taken Annie Chapman's belongings and laid them all out next to her body, a piece of muslin, a wooden comb, and a scrap of paper envelope containing 2 pills that she had been taking for her tuberculosis. When her body was identified by her friends, it was commented that she always wore 3 copper or imitation gold rings on her fingers. These were never found. Continue down Hanbury Street and turn left onto Wilkes Street. Take the second left onto Fournier Street, lined with original 18th century homes, giving you an idea of how the buildings in this neighborhood appeared in the 1880s. Take a right onto Brick Lane and walk down. Stop when you get to the junction with Thrall Street and you see the Shad restaurant. To get a good view, stand underneath the decorative archway that spans the road and look back at the Shad restaurant. Play the next clip as you walk. Throughout the course of the Ripper killings, both London police forces and numerous media outlets were inundated with letters claiming to be written by the unidentified killer. Many were quickly dismissed as obvious fakes, but there are a few that have stood the test of time and were believed then, and some even now, to have been legitimately the work of the murderer. The most famous letter, and the one most widely believed to potentially be genuine, is known as the Dear Boss letter. Addressed Dear Boss, the letter was postmarked and received by the Central News Agency of London on the 27th of September, 1888. Written after the murder of Annie Chapman, the letter was forwarded on to the police, who initially didn't release any of the details of the letter to the public. In this letter, the author mentions that when he kills his next victim, he will cut her ears off. If this letter is genuine, he's kept his promise, as the next night the Ripper went to work, one of his victims had her ears partially severed. Being as this information was not released to the public when it was received, many authorities and researchers believe this letter to be the real deal. When the slayings continued, true to the word of the author, the police eventually released facsimile versions of the letter, hoping members of the public would be able to identify the handwriting of somebody they knew. However, they had no success. The only lasting impact on this case that the Dear Boss letter had is that the author signed off the letter, quote, "Yours truly, Jack the Ripper," which he says is his trade name. Initially, the media and police were referring to the double murder as Leather Apron, a reference to a reported sighting of the killer wearing a leather apron, or simply the Whitechapel murderer. Whoever wrote the Dear Boss letter, killer or not, is the person who gave the murderer his nickname, Jack the Ripper, now notorious throughout the world. If you would like to see a copy of the Dear Boss letter, we've included one with this tour. This is the site of the former Frying Pan pub. Take a look at the red brick portico on the very top, and you will notice two crossed frying pans carved into the stone, the original decoration of this 19th century pub. This is the pub where Mary Nichols drank away her DOS money on the 30th of August, 1888. She is reported to have stumbled out of the pub around 12:30 and was seen by her friend just around the corner on Thrall Street a few minutes later. Somewhere between where you stand now and where our tour began, Mary would run into Jack the Ripper, and her life would come to a crushing end. Continue down Brick Lane. When you get to Whitechapel Road, cross the street and enter Altab Alley Park. Walk diagonally to your left through the park and exit the park onto Elder Street. Go right and immediately turn left onto Mulberry Street. Stop at the middle of the buildings on the right. None of the original buildings from the Victorian era still stand here, so you will have to use your imagination as you look at the Cubic Hotel across the street. In the 1880s, there was a square of houses here known as Zion Square. The densely populated area was home to two suspects in the Jack the Ripper murder, Aaron Kosminski and John Pizer. Aaron Kosminski, a schizophrenic Polish Jew working in the East End as a butcher, was a noted misogynist, and he had been arrested multiple times for violence against women. After a severe psychotic episode, he was forcefully committed into an institution in 1891, and no Ripper murders were carried out after 1888. In 1894, a memorandum that was written by Sir Melville McNaughton, the assistant chief constable of the Metropolitan Police, recorded that a Jewish man called Kosminski was a Polish suspect in the Jack the Ripper murders. The memo wasn't brought to light until it was discovered by his daughter in 1959 and wasn't released to the public until the 1970s. McNaughton's reasoning of listing Kosminski as a suspect was, quote, "He had a great hatred of women with strong homicidal tendencies." In memoirs published in 1910, Assistant Commissioner Sir Robert Anderson also named Kosminski as his prime suspect. His reasoning is that he believed Jack the Ripper was a local Jewish man of low class, and Kosminski was known to be mentally unstable, having previously threatened multiple women with knives. He also said he sent police to keep an eye on Kosminski for a time. Anderson also claimed that the identity of the Ripper was known by one person who wasn't willing to testify, as they were also Jewish and didn't want to turn over a fellow Jew to the police. This claim has led to a divide amongst historians and researchers as to whether it's true or not. Many believe this is just anti-Semitic rhetoric, and McNaughton states in his writings that nobody ever saw the killer. Another inspector, Edmund Reed, denied Anderson's claims also. It's worth noting that there is no record of Kosminski in any surviving official police documents, aside from McNaughton's memo. On the other hand, British author Russell Edwards bought at auction a shawl that was previously found at the scene of Catherine Eddowes's murder, which we will describe later. DNA from this shawl was analyzed and was matched to both female-line descendants of Eddowes and female-line descendants of Kosminski's sister, and was found to have a 99.2% match. However, these findings have never been peer-reviewed by other scientists or investigators, and many remain skeptical. Alleging the process may have been carried out indirectly, or Edwards could simply be fudging his evidence or lying. It's also worth mentioning that the shawl had been handled by dozens of people over the last century, so it could never positively be used for any exact DNA testing. Also living here at the time was John Pizer, a Polish Jew working as a bootmaker in Whitechapel. Before the Jack the Ripper moniker stuck, the murder suspect was known as Leather Apron, owing to reports from local prostitutes that there was a man in the area who would assault and rob them on the streets. The only identifying feature the police had on record about this man was that he was always wearing a leather apron. So after the murder of Marianne Nichols, many in the area assumed it was the Leather Apron at work. John Pizer had a prior conviction for a stabbing offense and was suspected in a string of assaults on local prostitutes. Given his work uniform, police suspected that Pizer was Leather Apron. He was arrested after the Ripper's first two murders, but was cleared as there was no concrete evidence against him, and he had strong alibis for the nights the murders were committed, including being in conversation with a police officer at the London docks at the time of one of the killings. Despite the fact that he was named as the killer by at least one London newspaper and was disliked by many people in the neighborhood, Pizer was never charged and had no further connection to the murders. Continue down Mulberry Street and take a right onto Plumber's Row. At the end of the road, turn right onto Coke Street and take the first left into Weyhill Road. When that road ends, turn left onto Commercial Road and take the first right onto Henrik Street, formerly known as Berner Street. Walk along until you come to the Bernard Baron Building on your left. You are now standing where Jack the Ripper's third victim would meet her untimely end. Elizabeth Stride was the Ripper's only non-English victim. She'd moved to London from Sweden at the age of 22 and married a local man, John Stride. Together they ran a coffee shop until they split up permanently in 1881. She had worked as a prostitute before she moved to London, and it appears that she took it up again after the collapse of her marriage. But she also did have work from wealthy families in the West End for whom she would do cleaning and sewing. This meant that, unlike Jack the Ripper's other victims, she was not actually a full-time prostitute, which made her all the more unlucky to have crossed the path of Jack the Ripper on one of the few nights she was working the streets. In the early hours of the 30th of September, a particularly wet and windy London night, a man called Louis Deem Schultz was returning with his pony and cart between the pub he ran and another building that stood here, trying to get through a pitch-black passageway to the stables at the back of his pub. This pathway would have exited right about where the school playground on the other side of the street stands today. In the middle of the alleyway, his horse stopped and shied away. Louis was puzzled. His horse had made this journey in the dark hundreds of times. He climbed down from his seat and began to feel around in the dark, unable to see anything in the blackness. Soon his hands came upon what he had first believed to be a clump of rags. He then knelt down and lit a match to get a better look. In the windy conditions of the night, his match went out almost immediately, but not before he could identify the body of a woman lying in front of him. Initially, Louis thought it was his wife, having picked her up at the same location numerous times after she had come home drunk on gin. Assuming it was just his sleeping wife, he left the body and went to his pub next door to grab his lantern and come back out to help her inside. However, as soon as Louis walked into the pub, the first person he saw was his wife. He then grabbed his lantern and returned to the scene of the crime, finding the body of Elizabeth Stride. She had only one slit across her neck and no other markings. Louis reported that her body was still warm and blood was still pouring from the wound around her neck. We already know that this was not the Ripper's practiced method. He would kill and then mutilate and disembowel his victims. So why not Elizabeth Stride? It is believed that this is because the Ripper was interrupted by Louis's arrival. His horse shied away, spooked by the movement of a person in the alleyway. And when Louis lit that match while he knelt down to investigate the mass on the ground, he was likely standing right in front of the killer. Perhaps if he had lit the match while standing upright, he would have been looking directly into the eyes of Jack the Ripper himself. Elizabeth's body was left relatively untouched, as the killer had been interrupted before he could complete his gruesome work, and Louis's retreat to the pub to pick up his lantern gave the culprit enough time to flee the area. But Jack the Ripper was not yet done for the night. Retrace your steps to Commercial Street and take a left. Follow the road until it dead ends, then take a left onto busy Whitechapel Street. Pass Aldgate Station, then Aldgate East Station, until you get to the Church of St. Botolph without Aldgate. This is your next stop. Please play the next clip as you walk. Recently published FBI records, accessible to the public for the first time thanks to the Freedom of Information Act, reveal a detailed criminal investigative analysis that was done by their offices in the 1980s. Examining all information, victimology and victim profiles, medical examiner's findings, crime and crime scene analysis, offender traits and characteristics, and more, the FBI have attempted to paint a portrait of who the Ripper may have been. Many of their conclusions match behaviors and attributes of some Ripper suspects, and although they don't give us a positive identification, it is fascinating to hear their assessment of the killer and what kind of person he may have been. We will now read a small paragraph of information concluded on by the FBI after their criminal investigative analysis. Should you wish to hear the analysis in full, there's an optional clip that you can play after this. White male, late 20s, early 30s. Obvious misogynistic views and a deep-seated hatred of women. From a broken home, abandoned by a father and left with an overly sexual or physically aggressive mother or other strong female family member. Likely lived in Whitechapel and in full-time employment. suffered from some sort of an impediment, such as speech or a limp. Likely had been picked up by police and interviewed about the Ripper case at least once, if not twice, and was likely to have been known by his victims. If you would like the in-depth version of the FBI analysis, simply play the clip after this. The following comes from a document produced by the FBI and published on the 6th of July, 1988, made recently available by the Freedom of Information Act. This information is based on an investigative analysis of the Jack the Ripper case 100 years after the crimes were originally committed. The FBI lists 11 characteristics of the 5 confirmed Jack the Ripper killings, followed by a crime scene analysis, offender traits and characteristics, and a summarization of pre- and post-defense behaviors. The 11 characteristics shared by all 5 killings are as follows. 1. No evidence of sexual assault. 2. Subject killed his victim swiftly. 3. Subject was able to maintain control of victims during an initial blitz-style attack. 4. Subject removed body organs, kidney, vagina, nose, on some of his victims, indicating some anatomical knowledge. 5. No evidence of physical torture prior to death. 6. Post-mortem mutilation. 7. Possible manual strangulation. 8. Blood from victims was concentrated in small areas. 9. Rings were taken from one of the victims. 10. The last victim was killed indoors and was the most mutilated. Subject spent a considerable amount of time at the scene. 11. Time of death was in the early morning hours. These listed findings will contribute to the overall offender analysis that will be addressed later on in the report. The crime scene analysis is as follows. With the exception of the last case, all victims were killed outdoors. All victims were killed swiftly, with the victim consequently receiving post-mortem mutilation. All homicides occurred within 1/4 of a mile from one another and occurred either on Friday, Saturday, or Sunday during early morning hours. After the first homicide at Whitechapel Station, the subject moved slightly across town, 1/4 of a mile. If a line is drawn from crime scenes 2, 3, 4, and 5, a triangular configuration is formed. This is observed in other types of serial crimes. This triangular configuration is viewed as a secondary comfort zone for the Ripper. This movement is caused when a subject believes that the investigation is heating up in his primary comfort zone. The primary comfort zone would be the location of the first homicide in the vicinity of Whitechapel Station. It is the opinion of this crime analysis that there were other attacks in the Whitechapel area that either went unreported or for some reason were not considered by authorities to be crimes of Jack the Ripper. Some criminologists and behavioral scientists have written in the past that subjects will maintain their modus operandi, and that is what links so-called signature crimes. This conclusion is incorrect. A subject will change his modus operandi as he gains additional experience. This is a learned behavior. However, the personal desires and needs of the subject are expressed in the ritual aspect of a crime. The ritual is something that he must always do because it is the acting out of the fantasy. With Jack the Ripper, the target selection, the approach, the method of his initial attack are his modus operandi. What takes place after this is the ritual. The ritual may become more elaborate, as was in the last homicide case. Here, the Ripper had time to act out his fantasies. As investigators, we should not necessarily expect the same type of homicides in the future, particularly if subsequent victims are killed outdoors. Once again, he would not have the time to carry out all of his fantasies, and consequently mutilation will not be as advanced. Offender traits and characteristics are as follows. These homicides are referred to as lust murders. The word lust does not mean love or have any sexual meaning, other than the fact that the subject attacks the genital areas of his victims. The vaginal area and the breasts are the focal point of attack in a woman, and the penis and scrotum are the attack area of the male offender. Generally, males who are attacked in this fashion are victims that were involved in a homosexual relationship. The writer of this document states that they have never experienced a female serial lust murderer, which means they believe the perpetrator is a man. The author goes on to explain that the offender does not look out of the ordinary. However, the clothing he wears at the time of the assaults is not his everyday dress. He wants to project to unsuspecting female prostitutes that he has money, Consequently, this relieves him from initiating contact. He comes from a family where he was raised by a domineering mother and a weak, passive, and/or absent father. In all likelihood, his mother drank heavily and enjoyed the company of many men. As a result, he failed to receive consistent care and contact with stable adult role models. Consequently, he became detached socially and developed a diminished emotional response towards his fellow man. He became asocial, preferring to be alone. His anger became internalized, and in his younger years, he expressed his pent-up destructive emotions by setting fires and torturing small animals. By perpetrating these acts, he discovered increased areas of dominance, power, and control, and learned how to continue violent destructive acts without detection or punishment. As he grew older, his fantasy developed a strong component that included domination, cruelty, and mutilation of women. He would expect to find evidence of this violent destructive fantasy life through personal writings of his, as well as drawings of women being mutilated. For employment, he would seek a position where he could work alone and vicariously experience his destructive fantasies. Such employment would include work as a butcher, mortician's helper, medical examiner's assistant, or hospital attendant. He is employed Monday through Friday, and on Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday is off from work. He has carried a knife for defense purposes, just in case he is ever attacked. He would be ready. This paranoid type of thinking is in part justified because of the poor self-image he has of himself. He would be expected to have some type of physical abnormality. However, although not severe, he would perceive this as being psychologically crippling. We would look for someone below or above average in height and or weight. May have problems with speech, scarred complexion, physical illness, or injury. We would not expect this type of offender to be married. If he was married in the past, it would have been to someone older than himself, and the marriage would have been for a short duration. He is not adept in meeting people socially, and the major extent of his heterosexual relationships would be with prostitutes. Due to lack of hygiene practices by prostitutes at that time and the absence of treatment for venereal disease, he may have been infected. If infected, this would further fuel his hatred and disgust for women. He would be perceived as being quiet, a loner, shy, slightly withdrawn, obedient, and neat and orderly in appearance when working. He drinks in the local pubs, and after a few spirits, he becomes more relaxed and finds it easier to engage in conversation. He lives or works in the Whitechapel area. The first homicide should be in close proximity to either his home or workplace. It is noted that London Hospital is only one block away from the first homicide, and as stated earlier in this analysis, we would expect other violent crimes in this vicinity. Investigators would have interviewed him during the course of the investigation, and he was probably talked to by police on several occasions. Unfortunately, at this time, there was no way to correlate this type of information. Therefore, he was overlooked. Investigators and citizens in the community had a preconceived idea or picture of what Jack the Ripper would look like. Because of the belief that he would appear odd or ghoulish in appearance, he was overlooked and/or eliminated as a potential suspect. Pre- and post-offense behavior is as follows. Prior to each homicide, the subject was in a local pub drinking spirits, while at the same time lowering his inhibitions. He would be observed walking all over the Whitechapel area during the early evening hours. He did not specifically seek a certain look in a woman. However, it was by no accident that he killed prostitutes. He had the sense to know when and where to attack his victims. There would have been many other women who confronted Jack the Ripper and were not assaulted because the location was not secure enough. Post-offense behavior would include returning to an area where he could wash his hands of blood and remove his clothing. We would not expect him to inject himself into the police investigation or provide bogus information. Jack the Ripper hunted nightly for his victims. When he could not find another, he returned to the locations where he killed his previous victims. If the victims were buried locally, he would visit the gravesites of his victims during the early morning hours for the purpose of reliving his lust murders. Jack the Ripper would not have committed suicide after the last homicide. Generally, when crimes such as these cease, it is because he came close to being identified, was interviewed by police, or was arrested for some other type of offense. As stated previously in this report, we would be surprised if Jack the Ripper would suddenly stop. However, we've seen this happen before, and generally it has been because of the above-stated reasons. Two police forces were operating in London during the time of the Jack the Ripper murders, and even up to the present day, the City Police and the Metropolitan Police. Technically speaking, the City of London is 1 square mile, existing on the site where the Romans founded Londinium. The city has its own mayor, its own laws, and its own police force, the city police. The rest of London is in the jurisdiction of the Metropolitan Police. Today, these forces work closely together, but in 1888, it was quite a different story. These two police forces were in direct competition with one another. They also refused to cooperate. If a murder took place inside the city of London, the Metropolitan Police wanted nothing to do with it, and vice versa. Today, this is marked as one of the reasons Jack the Ripper was never captured. A total lack of police cooperation meant that neither force would hold all the evidence, and nor would they share what they did have with the other. The one thing both forces agreed on, however, was that prostitution was illegal. But the police knew that, for the majority of Whitechapel women, prostitution was their only means of survival, which meant they weren't inclined to completely prevent women from selling themselves. This led to both the city police and the Metropolitan Police agreeing two rules with prostitutes in the area. One, prostitutes could not loiter or stay in a single place for a long time. They had to keep moving. Two, the women were not allowed to approach customers. The customers had to approach them. Providing the women followed these rules, the police would turn a blind eye. For this reason, up to 200 prostitutes a night continually walked in circles around this church, waiting for clients to approach them. In fact, back then St. Botolph was known as the Prostitute's Church, and it so happens that Jack the Ripper's fourth victim was last seen alive circling the building you stand in front of now. Get back onto the main road with the church on your right and continue on. Take the first right at Aldgate Square and walk along the primary school until you get to St. James's Passage. On your right are some interesting pictures and information about the history of the Whitechapel area, which may help you give a visual reference to how this area looked during the time these murders took place. After viewing those, turn left and walk between the buildings until the space opens into Mitre Square. Today, this is St. James's Passage, but in 1888 it was known as Church Passage, leading down to Mitre Square, which at that time was full of warehouses and would soon become the scene of the slaughter of the Ripper's fourth victim. The proximity of this location to St. Botolph's Church leads us to believe that after being interrupted during his slaying of Elizabeth Stride, Jack the Ripper headed straight to the Prostitute's Church to pick up his next victim, Catherine Eddowes. Although all of Jack the Ripper's victims could all be described as being in the wrong place at the wrong time, Catherine Eddowes' murder really never should have happened. Up until 1 hour before her horrific fate, Catherine was being held in police custody. A known harmless alcoholic, she had reportedly been spotted earlier in the evening, entirely drunk, impersonating a fire engine, before collapsing, being unable to stand any longer in her inebriated state. Around 8:30 p.m., a passing police officer, P.C. Louis Robertson, who recognized her, picked her up and took her back to Whitechapel Police Station. He had done this many times before and knew she would sleep off the alcohol in a holding cell. By 12:30, Catherine was wide awake and pounding on the door, begging to be let out. Around 30 minutes later, Robertson let Catherine go, telling her to go straight home. But instead of going home, Catherine walked right to St. Botolph's Church. An eyewitness report puts Catherine at the entrance of this alleyway at 1:35 a.m. in conversation with a man, said to be around 5'8", with a pale complexion and mustache. He was estimated to be in his late 20s or early 30s, wearing an oversized gray coat, a red neckerchief, and a peaked hat. He's said to have been of stocky build and described as, quote, a shabbily dressed gentleman of foreign appearance. It's worth noting here that in Whitechapel in 1888, foreign appearance actually meant Jewish. Now, this area, full of thieves and prostitutes hiding and trading in the warehouses of Mitre Square, was under near constant surveillance by the police. Every 15 minutes, a PC would come walking down the passage into the square on what was known as their beat, the path they would patrol through the neighborhood. The PC on duty the night of Catherine's murder was Edward Watkins. He had previously walked this way at 1:30 a.m. with nothing to report. But at his next go-around at 1:45 a.m., he found Catherine's mutilated body at the bottom of this passage in the darkest corner of Mitre Square. Whatever horrific and barbaric plans Jack the Ripper had been unable to carry out on Elizabeth Stride were leveled at Catherine Eddowes. The state of her body suggested a rage and fury that had not yet been seen in the Ripper case. This was a ferocious event. Catherine's neck was slit from the left to the right. Two pieces of flesh from her cheeks had been cut out. Her eyelids had been cut through, and the tip of her nose and tops of her ears had been severed. Her body had been torn open from her groin to her breasts, and her intestines removed and slung over her right shoulder. In the pitch dark of Mitre Square, in the space of less than 15 minutes, Jack the Ripper also successfully removed her kidney, and he took it with him. Now it may seem to us nearly unbelievable that a person could commit such a horrible crime and then wander off undetected into the night. This slaying was brutal. The killer would absolutely be covered in blood, not to mention carrying a kidney around, wandering the streets during the dead of night. So why did nobody notice? Because the sight of a man, as I've just described him, was incredibly, incredibly common. Slaughterhouses and butchers operated all over this area. Workers started their shifts at all hours of the day and night. A blood-soaked man walking down the street wouldn't have been remarkable to anybody living in Whitechapel at the time. In fact, there were even buckets of water kept along street corners in this area so men could rinse themselves off on their journeys back home. Jack the Ripper simply blended in with all the other men on their way home from their shifts in the slaughterhouses. Back at the Whitechapel police station, police surgeon Frederick Brown conducted an autopsy on Catherine's remains, and he was shocked to not only discover that her kidney had successfully been taken within the space of 15 minutes and with no light source, but that no other internal organs had been damaged. Brown became the first person to suggest that Jack the Ripper had some sort of surgical or anatomical knowledge, either human or animal. Perhaps Jack was a surgeon. Or perhaps he was one of the hundreds of butchers in Whitechapel. As you will have noticed already, we haven't spoken about any clues left behind at the crime scenes. That's because there haven't been any. Until now. However, nothing much would appear to come from this clue, and according to the FBI, this was actually a, quote, non-clue. But a clue nonetheless. A piece of Catherine Eddowes' apron was discovered a few hours later in Goulston Street, and above the bloody piece of apron was a message, written in red chalk, that said, quote, "The Jews are the men who will not be blamed for nothing." And now we will be walking in Jack's footsteps as we too head to Goulston Street. Walk to the end of Mitre Square and pause when you get to the gates on your left. Just through the gates is a tree. This is the approximate location of where Catherine Eddowes' body was found. Now, turn right onto Mitre Street. Take the first right onto Cree Church Lane, which you should then follow along until it turns into Stony Lane as you walk across Houndsditch Road. Walk ahead until you come to White Kennet Street, where you will make a right. Take the first left onto Gravel Lane and walk until the lane stops at Middlesex Street. Note that here, as you walk across Middlesex Street, you are leaving City of London police territory and now entering Metropolitan Police territory. Take a left, then an immediate right onto New Goulston Street. Walk until the street deadends on Goulston Street. Across the street here stands the Wentworth Model Dwellings, a large property that today houses shops and restaurants, but that in the 1880s housed 222 apartments, nearly all filled with Jewish tenants. Take a look at the doorway between numbers 40 and 41. This is the very doorway that Jack the Ripper came to almost immediately after murdering Catherine Eddowes. Around an hour after Catherine Eddowes' body was found in Mitre Square, P.C. Alfred Long was casually walking along this street, and right in front of that entranceway he stumbled across a bloody piece of cloth, later determined to be a shred taken from Catherine's apron. And written in red chalk next to this entryway were the words, "The Jews," spelled J-U-W-E-S, "are the men that will not be blamed for nothing." This is one of the only clues discovered during the period Jack the Ripper was active, and its true origins and intent confounded investigators in the 1880s and is still confounding us today. To understand this message, we need to understand the area we are in. You're currently standing in one of the most culturally diverse neighborhoods in London, and it has been so for centuries. 2,000 years ago, the Romans took this area away from the indigenous people when they and their armies moved in. In the 1700s, French Huguenots, fleeing persecution in Catholic France, came by the thousands to this area. In the 1800s, it was the Jewish community that came flooding into the East End, and it is they who populated this area for well over the next century. So many Jews lived in this part of town that the street you are standing on, Wentworth Street, had over 15 kosher butchers in 1888, and this building, the Wentworth Dwellings, was a Jewish tenement. The 1880s also saw huge immigration from Ireland, those fleeing their country en route to a better life in the United States, who would stop here to find work and earn the money they would need to take them to their new lives across the Atlantic Ocean. Then, in the 1970s, fleeing persecution in East and West Pakistan, the Bangladeshi immigrants began to arrive, many of whom still live here today. So as you see, the East End has been a draw for immigrants from all across the globe spanning back centuries. And as these waves of immigration ebbed and flowed, it could oftentimes create explosive outcomes. Wentworth Street was a boiling pot of racial tension in the 1880s. Anti-Semitism was rife, with native British citizens competing for the same jobs and housing as their immigrant counterparts. So when Detective Chief Inspector Aberline and Commissioner Charles Warren were alerted to this chalk-written message, quote, "The Jews, J-U-W-E-S, are the men that will not be blamed for nothing," they immediately order it to be scrubbed off the wall, and rejected the idea that a photograph should be taken first. The police were fearful that this message would spark a riot in the streets. With such widespread anti-Semitism and the writing of this message on a building inhabited nearly entirely by Jewish people, it can be looked as a moderately understandable decision to have been made. However, today it is a clear destruction of crime scene evidence and a guaranteed way to spread animosity between the two police forces operating in Victorian London. The City of London police hadn't even arrived at the scene to look at the message before it was wiped from the walls, which, as you can imagine, did not go down well. The city police were outraged. Catherine Eddowes was killed within the districts of the City of London, and this bloody piece of apron and messages were crucial to their investigation, despite the fact that this street was technically in the jurisdiction of the Metropolitan Force. So with no real evidence left behind, we are left only with contemporary reports and theories, no official police records. And what can we learn from what we are left with? Not a lot. Theories abound surrounding this graffiti. Most people in 1880s Whitechapel were illiterate. Does that mean Jack the Ripper wasn't working class, but did, in fact, have an education? Then again, the double negative in the sentence structure isn't recognized in English grammar, so does that mean the Ripper was translating from his own language? French, Yiddish, or Polish, perhaps? And why was Jews spelt incorrectly? Because the author didn't know how to spell it? Or because J-U-I-V-S is how it's spelled in French? Or was it part of a Masonic conspiracy? The Jews referring to Jubala, Jubalo, and Jubellum, three men who killed Hiram Abiff, a legendary Masonic figure. Or maybe the message was a red herring, designed to throw investigators off his trail by focusing attention on the Jewish community. Or did the message have nothing to do at all with Jack the Ripper? Sure, a shred of Catherine Eddowes' apron was found underneath it, but that could be a coincidence. Maybe this message wasn't from the killer, but from somebody else. A regular person who just wanted to harass the residents of this tenement, and the fact that Catherine's apron was found nearby was simply happenstance. Maybe it was accidentally dropped by the killer as he walked by, paying no attention to the words on the walls as he strolled past. The truth is that it's unlikely we'll ever get answers to any of these questions. All police investigations were inconclusive, and almost 150 years on, we are still none the wiser. So what information did the police retrieve from the crime scene? One important thing. The piece of apron found here showed that the bloodied blade of a knife had been swiped against it. The pattern of the knife blade appeared to be that belonging to a type of knife used in surgical amputations. So at the very least, this suggested to the police that Jack the Ripper had access to surgical weapons. With New Goulston Street at your back, turn left onto Goulston Street. Keep walking and Goulston Street turns into Bell Lane. Keep following until you see Frying Pan Alley on your left. Just past this, still on Bell Street, on your left-hand side, is the old workhouse. So we know already that 4 pence was required to stay the night indoors for most poor citizens of Victorian Whitechapel, and that women could earn this money on the streets and men could labor for 16 hours a day on the docks. But what about everybody else? Children who had been abandoned by parents who couldn't afford to feed them and who were too young to work? The elderly who weren't physically able to work the docks or the streets? Or people who were ill, physically or mentally? With no modern-day understanding of medicine and science, the mentally ill were left to their own devices, and chronic outbreaks of things like syphilis could damage the physical and mental well-being of the thousands of infected people living in this area. Or what about those who could work, but hadn't made their 4 pence? Where would these unfortunate end up? Here, the end of the line, the workhouse. You'll notice 2 entrances here, separate doorways for men and women. On a typical day, you would have around 200 women and children queuing up for a place in the house, and a similar number of men on the other side as well. The dormitories themselves only slept 200. Rooms were stuffed with coffin-shaped boxes filled with 6-inch horsehair mattresses. If a person arrived when all the beds had been allocated, they would be given a rope attached to the wall, and they would have to sleep upright, hanging against this rope, which led to these people being referred to as hangers-on. Dinner was a bowl of thin gruel and a chunk of bread so stale it had to be soaked in boiling water before it could be eaten. Especially as very few people in this sort of environment would still have all their teeth. Teeth were a luxury in 19th century Whitechapel. Before sleeping for the night, visitors were required to take a bath in water that was changed once a month. Rats and mice roamed freely. Insects were climbing up the walls. There was little to no ventilation at all, and infections were rife. These workhouses were horrendous places to be. And the price for all of this? A 16-hour shift of manual labor, breaking rocks for those who were physically able, and unraveling ropes, later used to make sacks, for everybody else. Today this building serves as student accommodation for the London School of Economics, and are hopefully a little bit more comfortable today than they were over a century ago. With the workhouse to your back, look across the street to the modern building directly opposite you. This building sits on the site of what used to be Dorset Street and the location of Jack the Ripper's final slaying. In the 19th century, Dorset Street was considered to be the most dangerous street in London, and some said even the entire country. A person walking down that street in the 1880s would unlikely make it all the way down retaining all their possessions, and they'd be lucky to come out alive. In fact, when the police normally walked their beats through town, they would do so by themselves or with a partner. But when walking down Dorset Street, they would only come in groups of 4. And this awful street is the murder site of the Ripper's final victim, Mary Jane Kelly, who lived at 13 Miller's Court here on Dorset Street. A 24-year-old Irish girl, Mary Jane Kelly was to be the last of Jack the Ripper's known victims. Her murder was so brutal, and the desecration of her corpse so barbaric, the only way she could be identified was by the clothing she had been wearing the night before. The FBI still described the location of her murder as the most complex crime scene on record, and her mutilated corpse in the room where she died provided the first forensic crime scene photo in history. Why was Mary Jane Kelly's body brutalized beyond recognition instead of following the same pattern as his earlier victims? For one very good reason. Hers was the first of the Ripper's murders to take place indoors. Without having to constantly look over his shoulder to avoid detection, the murderer had all the time in the world to carry out his barbaric and twisted fantasies. At the time of her murder, on the 9th of November 1888, Mary Jane was 6 weeks behind in rent, in debt to a man called John McCarthy, who owned many of the buildings on Dorset Street. The night of her death, she was drinking in the Ten Bells pub and had arranged to meet a client on nearby Miller's Row. We know she made it back to her home that night because a neighbor heard her singing an Irish lullaby around 2 o'clock in the morning and again around 3 o'clock. However, these would be the last signs of life Mary Jane ever exhibited. A few hours later, once the sun had come up, John McCarthy sent one of his goons, an ex-military man called Thomas Bowyer, over to Mary Jane's room to collect on her delayed rent. After no response to his banging on the door and shouting, he walked outside to try to get her attention through a broken window pane on the side of a room. There is nothing that could have prepared Thomas for what he witnessed through that window. Mary Jane's body had been mutilated beyond all recognition. Her head had been nearly severed, and her entire body had been cut into 2. Her intestines had been removed and hung on various objects throughout the room, scattered among other pieces of her body and organs that had been severed and thrown about. Piles of her skin lay on window frames in neat piles, and her heart had been removed from the crime scene, never to be recovered. And this horrific scene provided the imagery of the first ever crime scene photograph. From here, we will walk to the location where Jack the Ripper would have emerged from Dorset Street all those years ago. Still with the workhouse behind you, turn left and take an immediate right down Broome Street. When the road dead ends, turn left onto Toynbee Street and walk until you get to the corner of Toynbee Street and White's Row. This is approximately where Dorset Street would have emptied out onto the main road, and where Jack the Ripper would have walked as he left the scene of his last crime. Now stop to imagine what Jack the Ripper would have done after brutally savaging Mary Jane Kelly's body beyond all recognition. He would have walked out of her room, headed down Dorset Street and onto the road we are standing on right here. And what would he have seen? Nearly exactly what you are seeing right now. Firstly, St. Christ Church, Spitalfields. The current version of the church was designed by Hawksmoor in the 1720s, and the clock on top of the building was how the people of Whitechapel kept track of the time. Secondly, Spitalfields Market. There's been a market here on this site since the 1600s, originally selling fish, flesh and fowl, and fruit and veg. This version of the market you see today is the same that Jack the Ripper would have seen, as this building was opened by Queen Victoria in 1987, a year before the murders began. And the Ten Bells Pub, an integral part of the Jack the Ripper case. All five of his victims were known drinkers at the Ten Bells. In fact, Mary Jane Kelly was drinking at the pub the night she met her unfortunate end right across the street. It is the belief of investigators both at the time and now that whoever Jack the Ripper was, it's incredibly likely he was a regular at the Ten Bells. Now cross the street to Christ Church and stand nearby, surveying the buildings here and the unchanged streets surrounding you as we pause to consider who Jack the Ripper may have been. There have been over 300 suspects in the Jack the Ripper murder investigations. For brevity's sake, we will take you down a few of the top suspects. Aaron Kosminski, as detailed previously. Montague Druitt, a school teacher and banker who fit the physical description of Jack the Ripper, and a suicide shortly after Mary Jane Kelly's death led many to believe that he was the culprit, including members of his own family. Walter Sickert, a well-known impressionist artist. He had a known interest in Jack the Ripper, and there is a painting he did of Jack the Ripper's bedroom that he created after spending the night in a room that was said to have been the Ripper's. This interest has led some to believe that he was the Ripper himself, with some accusers claiming many of his paintings are representations of the different Ripper crime scenes. Or what about a member of the royal family? Queen Victoria's eldest son, Prince Albert Victor, Duke of Clarence, has been brought up repeatedly as a suspect. This rumor began in the 1960s, 70 years after his death. The story stated that Albert had inadvertently fathered a child with a young prostitute in the Whitechapel area. Not wanting to bring scandal to the royal family, it was decided that she needed to be killed to be silenced, along with any other women that knew about the baby. Dr. Francis Tumbledee, an American quack doctor from upstate New York. He was living in Whitechapel at the time of the murders and largely fits the physical description of Jack the Ripper as given by eyewitnesses. He'd been arrested multiple times in the U.S. for multiple crimes and was well known for his hatred of women, but especially prostitutes, whom he always referred to as, quote, whores. He was picked up and interviewed several times during the Jack the Ripper investigation, having fit the FBI profile quite well. He had been married previously, and the marriage had broken down as his wife began engaging in prostitution. He had an abusive mother and would have been a loner in the area. But he'd been in Whitechapel long enough that he would have been known to the women working the streets. Around the time Mary Jane Kelly was murdered, Francis had been caught by the police engaging in indecent acts, at this time this means homosexual acts, and was let out on bail. Before he could be tried, however, he fled the country. Back in the United States, Tumbledee began to display a collection of uteruses preserved in jars that he proudly showed to his dinner guests. Already a wanted man in the United Kingdom, both for his indecent acts and as a Ripper suspect, the UK attempted to extradite him, but the United States argued that there was not enough evidence to suggest he was involved in any murders and refused the request. There are dozens more, and even suggestions of a Jane the Ripper rather than a Jack. But each theory has its supporters and detractors, and the reality of the situation is that it's highly unlikely the killer's identity will ever be positively known. The Jack the Ripper murders were horrific and brutal crimes, and, at first glance, it would seem there's nothing positive or good to take away from the story. But to try to end on a lighter note, It is worth mentioning that the Ripper killings had long-lasting and far-reaching positive ramifications for the people of the East End. This now legendary story was the first tabloid murder sensation. 1 million newspapers were printed daily referring to Jack the Ripper all across the globe. In fact, the New York Times reported on the case daily. It's worth mentioning that literacy rates were so low in the 19th century that many of the newspapers were printed in comic book-style illustrations so that regular people could follow the story. But with all this attention on Whitechapel, people all over the world were wondering why, in the richest and largest city on earth, were their own people living in these horrific conditions. Massive social reform came about as a result of the Jack the Ripper murders. Homeless children were collected on the streets by new charities such as Bernardo's, who would send them across the seas for better lives elsewhere. The Good Samaritans and the Church of England all got involved in trying to change conditions for the poorest in society. Millionaires from the U.S. invested unimaginable amounts of their own money to build new accommodations for the people in London's East End, changing the lives of those who otherwise may have been trapped in Whitechapel slums for the rest of their lives. If you've enjoyed your Jack the Ripper tour with us and wish to take another self-guided tour, visit our website at www.freetoursbyfoot.com. There you will find self-guided tours of Roman London, Westminster, Harry Potter, and more. You will also find information on other audio tours that we offer and also our full tour schedule. Free Tours by Foot offers pay-what-you-like walking tours on a daily basis here in London, and we'd love to have you join us. Simply book online. Thank you for touring with Free Tours by Foot today, and we hope you've enjoyed every step of your journey.